my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Melvin Morris.
Thank you so much. It's a great, great pleasure to be here in Salt Lake City. I'm a former critical care physician. I work for Airlift Northwest out of Seattle Children's Hospital. And I have resuscitated hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of critically ill children. And most of them died. So for the first part of my career, most of my patients died. I trained at Johns Hopkins. I was always taught the gods that I worship, Plumb and Posner, who wrote the book, The Diagnosis of Stupor and Coma. They wrote, Coma Wipes Clean the Slate of Consciousness. So that's my opinion. This changed when I had the opportunity of resuscitating a young girl in a community swimming pool in Pocatello, Idaho. And as I saw her later in a follow-up, I said to her, you know, what do you remember being in the hospital? She was flown here to primary children's here at Salt Lake City. I was really just making conversation. And she said, oh, do you mean when I was in heaven with the Heavenly Father? That did not particularly impress me for a simple reason. Her family had prayed constantly at her bedside, and so I just assumed that the spiritual aspects of her experience were some sort of invention of the mind struggling to deal with problems of near death and the anxiety and fear that she, of course, was suffering. But she saw the disbelief on my face, and she patted me on the wrist, and she said, oh, you'll see, Dr. Morris, heaven is fun. And she then proceeded to tell us, blow by blow, everything that happened to her and her experience. Chance conversations that nurses had. She said, I saw you go over to the phone and call somebody, and you said, what am I supposed to do now? Because it was my opinion at that time that we should stop resuscitatory efforts. I wanted to get the word from the children's. She was in a community swimming pool underwater for 19 minutes. So, critical care doc, we believe that if they're not warm and dead, they're not dead. Word was, I was to transport her to primary children's, and I did so. But it was remarkable that she could remember these things. And that's what interested me about her experience. At the time, I was doing a postdoctoral fellowship in neuroscience at the University of Washington. I was set to go down to University of California. And instead, I got our research team. I've studied these experiences for the last 25 years. My motivation has been a simple one. Most of my patients, as I told you, died. The great majority of those parents have spiritual visions involving their children. This is not controversial. In medical literature, 50 to 75% of grieving parents have vivid spiritual experiences concerning the death of their child. But we consider them to be hallucinations. They're not considered to be real with a prevailing psychiatric and psychological outlook of that time and at this time. So when a mother had heard me describe her son's near-death experience, she asked me a question. She said, if his experience is real, the near-death experience, what about my experience? The circumstances of this family, I'll show you a video of this family in a moment, were that they had plunged off of the side of a bridge into a river in the Cascade Mountains, and they were submerged in about 20 feet of water. And her husband was immediately killed on impact. And she was heroically saved by passerbys. And then he was ultimately taken out of the young man was taken out of the back of the car and transported and ultimately resuscitated. And her experience was that as she sat on the side of the riverbank watching the frantic resuscitative efforts of her son, as we tried to get her son out of the car, get him into the helicopter, she perceived that her husband was sitting there next to her. If there's one thing I can share with you all about these experiences, is that these experiences are vividly real. They are just as real as this experience. And that's crucial in understanding them. For those of you who haven't had a spiritual experience, I just really encourage you to understand that point. that the experience is just as real as this experience. And she told me that her husband was sitting there next to her, smiling at her and saying everything is all right. And she was furious. And she said, why aren't you down there helping them try to save your son? How can you possibly tell me everything is all right? She turned to him, and he smiled at her and then vanished. And so when she heard of her son's near-death experience, she made the common sense association. So was my experience real? And I've taken their questions very seriously. It's been 25 years. I've endeavored to understand that question. Are these experiences real? Along the way, I've learned a lot about living, calling this talk Lessons from the Light, what we can learn from children who've nearly died. Not put too fine a point on it, these children died. That's all there is to it. I don't want to get into a big argument over what's death, but these are children that by and large are resuscitated myself. They had fixed and dilated pupils, did not have spontaneous respiratory activity. They were what we would call clinically dead. What can we learn from children who died and came back to life? It's just a good way of saying it. This talk is with the International Association for Near-Death Studies. I really appreciate Martin Tanner inviting me here and President Bill English. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I don't really enjoy this. I'm just being blunt with you, because I want you all to know why I'm here. That's my family. I have a 9-year-old and a 4-year-old. I don't really like to travel. I'm a physician, so I have the luxury of, I don't have to get paid for this stuff. But on the other hand, there's probably nobody else in the world who has actually resuscitated children and heard what they had to say about nearly dying. See, that's an obligation. Now, most of the controversies that I read about, and I know there's a big resurgence of interest in near-death experiences, I'm always seeing all kinds of stuff and books written by various people and all this kind of stuff, I can just bluntly tell you that it's all nonsense. I don't fault them for their conclusions or what they have to say, because they're trying to make sense of it from the point of view of hearing the story told again and again and again. And they're not critical care physicians, and they haven't resuscitated patients. For example, there's a best-selling book out right now that the guy says he's figured out why they see the light. Has to do with as the light comes in and the dying brain and all this kind of stuff. Actually, we tape their eyes closed when we resuscitate dying patients. They're not seeing anything. We don't feel like dirt and stuff getting into their eye. Their eyes are taped closed. So they're not seeing operating room lights. They're not seeing a collapse of tunnel vision or any of that kind of stuff. But it's if they have resuscitated patients, they just don't know. So do appreciate this opportunity to share this information with you. It's made a big difference in my own life. And if there's one person here that makes a difference in your life, that's cool. And I'm glad I came. University professor reveals new proof of life after death from people who've been to a world beyond the grave and returned. I understand that that is a very common sense way of looking at these experiences. And I understand that people are incredibly fascinated with these experiences as proof of life after death. I do. I get that. Sure, as you'll see, they're pretty powerful circumstantial proof that we don't need a brain to think, that there's probably life after death. But, oddly enough, that's not what I'm going to talk about today. Nor is that ever been my interest in these experiences. So I'm just sharing that with you, and just to try to sort of get that out of the way. Everybody here is going to die, so you guys will you'll figure it out. But what we have to learn about these experiences has something so powerful about living itself. And so as the poet T.S. Eliot said, it's worthwhile dying to find out what life is. What life is. This is a young girl here. I guess you can't really use a pointer. This young girl that nearly died of fulminant bacterial meningitis. This is my partner, David Christopher, resuscitating her. I was also in my hospital at the Seattle Children's Hospital instructor for cardiac resuscitation, and I gave Dr. Christopher an A based on this young girl's drawing. He has his arms perfectly flexed, the fingers are interdigitated, and properly placed on her chest. For those of you who think that this experience is an embellishment of mind, or that it's from children watching too much television and just naturally making the association, if you guys, if my wife was here, she'd tell you that I can't even bear to watch those shows like ER and all that stuff because everything they do is wrong. But this young girl got it all right. Not only that, notice that the figure at the head of the bed is wearing a hat. Why is that significant? At our hospital, the leader of resuscitations wears a hat so that they can be quickly identified in the hubbub. The girl is then rising out of her body. On the left upper corner is a rainbow, and she told me that was a rainbow that told her who she was and where she was to go. You guys are, well, many of you are Mormons. You're probably familiar with Betty Eady's book. I wrote the foreword to that book, and I love Betty. I was her pediatrician for her grandchildren. And, but I mean, you know, it's 143 pages, on and on and on. Her experience goes on forever. You know, you can see why I love these children's experiences. Told me who I was and where I was to go. And then this is Jesus sitting on a rock. I'm sure everybody here, or most of you all are Christians, you'll be very happy to know that she told me that Jesus was very nice. So, and then down here on the bottom right-hand corner, it's a little faded, but she says, "I like you very much, Dr. Morse." And then this is a door that grandpas and grandmas and babies go through, apparently, to be reborn. Although she didn't quite say that. She just said they go through it. Children tell very fragmentary experiences, and they don't really change their story very much. They don't tell coherent stories. So if we're to assume that this experience is the mind struggling to fill a memory gap, as many people logically do, and rightfully do, but nevertheless, then you've got to wonder, well, why don't they tell a full experience then? Why don't they tell a seamless story? And they don't. They tell little fragments that don't make a whole lot of sense. What are the implications of this research? Arvin Gibson is a Utah-based near-death researcher. He said that if near-death experiences are real, it means that instead of life being a chance event destined to be obliterated in future stellar explosions, life becomes the purpose behind cosmic eruptions. This, to me, is the fundamental issue of near-death experiences. Almost any issue that you all struggle with in your life, I guarantee you, comes down to this central point. The question is, do we as human beings impose order on a random universe that makes no sense? And you will find that issue coming up again and again, whether you're struggling to understand what the heck is going on with your marriage, or where your kids should go to college, or, I mean, really, that seems to be the central question. Are we imposing our own values and standards and our own order on a chaotic universe? Or are we looking into the universe to find signs or a way of greater understanding that is talking to us in a subtle way? And that's what I understood Arvin Gibson to mean from this. And that is, as you'll see, what I learned from near-death experiences. This is, in fact, a Crystal Merzlock. I'll narrate it for you. Crystal's telling us that she's on a community swimming pool. A little boy pushed her in, and she's underwater for about 18 minutes. So, Crystal Merzlock, we resuscitated her. She was underwater for 19 minutes. She was transported here to Salt Lake City and was comatose for 3 days. I just happened to be moonlighting in a clinic in Pocatello, Idaho, that's based, of course, in Seattle. Those of you who believe there's no accidents, it was not an accident that I happened to see her in follow-up. And she looks at her mom and she goes, There's a man who put a tube in my nose, which I quite doubted she knew, because she was clinically dead at the time that I saw her, with fixed and dilated pupils, and a time that it was irreversible to us, was the onset of irreversible brain damage. And as I told you before, she went on for a complete blow-by-blow account of her own resuscitation. And she said, "Oh yes, I do know who you are." And I believe her. There is no question about it. She could not have known all of those details unless something extraordinary is going on in the way that we understand that the way the human brain works, specifically how memories are stored. Because it did not seem rational to me that memories could be stored in the brain and she could remember all these details of her experience. Unless that seemed like neuroscientific heresy to anybody here, I would like to quickly add that as of this time, we have no modern theory of how memory is stored in the brain. That's absolutely true. So, as you're going to see, I don't feel that anything in the near-death experience violates what we know about science. To me, science and the near-death experience are completely compatible. That's my wife. Certainly, though, if we don't have a theory of how memory can be stored in the brain, obviously, it's permissible to speculate that memories are stored outside the brain. How could that be? Actually, more simply than you might think. This entire world is actually composed of a very odd wave particle sort of uncertainty. You guys think this desk here is really solid? It's not. The distance between the atoms in this lectern are greater than the distance between the planets. Depending on how theoretical physicists look at this lectern, depending on how they look at it, it could be a wave or a particle, or zero or one. What a wonderful system for being able to store memory. So I returned to Seattle Children's Hospital, and I was determined to study these experiences. At that time, there had been no scientific studies of near-death experiences of the sort that we proposed. Prior to that time, there was collections of stories, which of course were important to establish that these are a real phenomenon and people have it. But I returned to Seattle Children's Hospital, and we studied near-death experiences in a very systematic way. We studied all survivors of cardiac arrest at Seattle Children's Hospital over a 15-year period of time. And we carefully compared each one of those patients to a patient who had a lack of oxygen to the brain, who had all kinds of medications, who had serious diseases that caused them to be hospitalized in the scary intensive care unit, so they had every reason to think they were going to die, and they were intubated and mechanically ventilated. So again, you know, all the things we often hear about, near-death experiences are caused by lack of oxygen in the brain, near-death experiences are caused by this, caused by that. We carefully looked for all of those in our study. We were funded by the National Cancer Institute. If you're going to do something as unusual as study near-death experiences, it's best to have the most mainstream and normal people on board. Don Tyler was the head of intensive care unit at the time. Jerry Milstein was head of child neurology at Seattle Children's Hospital at the time. Kimberly Clark, now affiliated with the International Association of Near-Death Studies. She was a social worker that worked with us. Nancy Evans-Bush helped us with research design. And we worked with two other institutions. I was based at the University of Washington, so I worked with my mentor, Vernon Nepi. And we worked with Bruce Grayson, who was then at the University of Connecticut, and Bill Sedaly at the University of Montana. And I'm going to perseverate a little bit on my research design, because our conclusions are so startling that I feel that you need to know the rigor that we went through in our research. We asked a very simple research question. What memories do children have after surviving cardiac arrest? And how do their memories compare to what we call adult near-death experiences? And what experiences do a seriously ill control group have? A control group that, frankly, the parents and child think they're going to die. is just our judgment as physicians is that one group had a greater than 90% chance of dying, and the other group had a less than 5% chance of dying. If you take your average child who is intubated, mechanically ventilated, and has a horrifying condition such as epiglottitis, in which their windpipe is swelling up, they think they're going to die. So this is an important issue, because I often see people tell, well, they're hallucinations of the dying brain, or they're an effort to struggle with the fear of death, or these types of very logical thoughts, but as it turns out, our research did not support any of them. Our critically ill group, these patients are the sickest of the sick. We went through over 500 patients, and only 26 fit our study criteria. So they're truly at the point of death. And our seriously ill controls are seriously ill by any criteria. As I indicated to you before, I particularly liked the cases of epiglottitis because they happen to children between age 3 and age 5, which are the fantasy-prone years. So if this is some sort of fantasy of the mind, we would expect that these children would have the experience. Drug overdoses, every type of thing you can imagine. We had hundreds and hundreds of control patients. And we made sure that they had the same lack of oxygen in the brain, same types of drugs, etc. At the time, our bias was that a dissociative agent called halothane caused the near-death experience. That was my own personal opinion. We know that this drug causes dissociation, and we routinely used it in resuscitating critically ill children. And I'm a pediatrician. I'm quite aware that if you say to a child, "Do you have monkeys in your ear?" Say yes. Dramatic proof of a race of tiny monkeys in a child's ear? Absolutely not. Children want to please powerful adults who ask them questions. And so we didn't do that. We asked them very straightforward, open-ended questions. What do you remember about being in a hospital? Stuff like that. What do you remember about being unconscious or asleep or, you know, whatever it is that they're... age, what do you think happens when we die, describe your family's religious beliefs, etc. And our results were startling. Virtually every critically ill child had a near-death experience. Many of them had never told their parents. Many of them had never told anyone. One child I interviewed, we interviewed her. It took us a couple of months to get to her and follow up and all that kind of stuff. And she was already seeing a psychiatrist, and she was having nightmares because of her near-death experience. And I said to her, "Well, why didn't you just tell your mom, you know, that you had this experience?" And she said, "I didn't think we were supposed to be able to talk to God." And I think that pretty much sums it up, that I'm not particularly religious, but just for fun, just to prove the point I'm going to make to you, I'll often go to a party, and I'll start talking about my relationship with God. And I'll start telling people that I talk to God on a regular basis, that means a lot in my life, and guess what? Very few people want to talk to me. It's true. Might be a little different in this community, I don't know. But I can just tell you that our society's set point, if you want to know the valid near-death experience or the valid spiritual experience in the 21st century, here's how it begins. You will think I'm crazy, but... And then they'll tell you the most beautiful experience you've ever heard. And I'd like to just share with you, just really quick, what about the two that didn't have? What about the two that didn't have an experience? What a riot. One of them was a young girl that they were in a fishing... she went fishing with her dad in Lake Washington, and she fell overboard, and she fell about 20 feet in water. Her dad and his best friend freedove for her. And finally, they couldn't find her because it was too dark. Seattle's a very overcast city, and she was lost in the muck. But they state that her body was suddenly lit up with a bright light that seemed to come from within her. And they were able to locate her body because of that. Pulled her to the surface, and she was ultimately resuscitated. She had no memory of her experience. So she's in the didn't have an experience group. And of our seriously ill patients, they followed the neurology that I learned in school. They didn't have any memory at all. They lost their short-term memory by coming to the hospital. They asked them, what do you remember about being intensive care unit or whatever? They had no memories at all. Okay, our study was then replicated in adults by Pin von Lommel, published in The Lancet, the world's most prestigious medical journal in 2001. Dr. von Lommel met with us several times in the 1990s because we wanted to make sure that our research designed in children and his research designed in adults precisely matched. Our study was published in the American Medical Association's pediatric journal, prestigious journals. The United Nations launched a study of near-death experiences in 2008, involving 25 medical centers throughout the world. So near-death research is solid scientific research. What kind of experiences did we have? We were willing to accept anything as a near-death experience. One child said that she floated out of her body and she saw her mother, and her mother looked like a pig monster. And we called that a near-death experience. Because we did not want to shape or limit our data in any way. We didn't want to make any assumptions as to what an experience was. So we all experienced. We did not in any way shape or tailor them. And yet, by and large, they fit into what less rigorous studies have called near-death experiences. Dr. Moody's study, Dr. Ring's study, are primarily surveys in which they would survey large groups of people and they would tell them about what near-death experience was like. Our study validated these previously done surveys. They had the sensation of being out of their physical body. This is a very nice experience here. In the top left corner, this is a young man who nearly drowned. He says that hands reached into his body and pulled him to safety and plunged him into darkness. And there can be no doubt that this darkness is the cessation of our ordinary senses. And that's all there is to it. Crystal Merzlach, if we've been able to hear her experience, is so amazing. She goes, I wasn't dead at all. I was alive. There's an enormous amount of surprise he's plunged into darkness. So all this stuff about double innervation of the retinal nerve and the optic nerve still transmitting light at the point of death, and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't, great theories, I have no doubt about it, by people that are a lot smarter than me. But nevertheless, it simply doesn't match the data. The data is they're in darkness, then this darkness evolves. And I want you all to remember this particular slide, because I'm going to come back to it later, so that you can understand the neuroscience of the near-death experience and what it tells us about reality. Because we see it evolves into colors and shapes, and then a very simple schematic drawing of a pup tent. This boy was a Boy Scout, so that's his head. And then into a more evolved picture, heaven being an open field, with again this rainbow in the top left corner. So for this young man, heaven is a pup tent and a golden field. And there, there's a lot of research. I did a study called a transformation study of what happens to these children when they grow up. And there's a lot of evidence that they have a lot of extra skills. They have greater intelligence, such as that. This is an 11-year-old boy drawing this picture. That's remarkable. I can't really tell you that as a solid scientific fact. We don't have samples of his drawing before his near-death experience and afterwards, blah, blah, blah. But come on. That's a pretty cool picture. There's the darkness, and there's the light, and then there's what heaven is for this young man. Okay? Then they see their own body. And so here we are, we're looking down, and again, they get all these details correct. This young girl here said that there was two female doctors resuscitated her. That is correct. Those are two female doctors. At the time that we did our study, starting in the early 1990s, probably 20% of the physicians in our hospital were females. I'm just saying, all these little details add up. They're wearing green masks. That's correct. They thought that she had an infectious process when she came in. She was actually dying of diabetes, and so they wore green masks. All of these little details. She doesn't have an IV in place. That's correct. They couldn't get an IV in her. Then they had a sense of traveling in a tunnel. This is Crystal Merzlach's picture. She said that a woman named Elizabeth came to her. They went down a tunnel to a place that she thought was heaven. And I love interviewing children. So I said, well, who's Elizabeth? Well, I don't know. Well, why did Elizabeth come to see you? I don't know. Why Elizabeth? Why not somebody else? I don't know. You know, so they don't, in fact, invest these experiences. This is a young man. He said that he went down a tunnel that was lined with airplane landing lights. That was his entire experience. They enter into the darkness. So there's a nice example of a long, dark tunnel, and then this sort of rainbow bridge. I asked him, what are these blue diamonds in the top left corner there? I don't know. This is a very nice example of that, again, that this tunnel, whatever it is not some sort of creation of our retina and the optic nerve and such as that, as I've seen many people write about and consider as a possibility. Because she's showing us right now that she's at the edge of the tunnel, that she's half in and half out. And she's looking at a place that she perceives as being heaven. And as she says it very beautifully, she says, the blue that is bluer than the blue we have here. The yellow that is yellower than the yellow we have here. Here's another nice example. We can see the tunnel is now converting to a light-filled tunnel, and there's a second realm. And this boy had his near-death experience when he was 9 months old, and then told us about the experience at age 3. And he said he could run and double jump with God. That's what the meaning of his experience was. This boy was part of our formal study, but it is very interesting how he came to our attention. We had not gotten around to studying him yet, but his parents took him to one of these passion plays, which is a play about Jesus. And he got very angry, and he said, that's not Jesus. And he was very emphatic. I have seen the real Jesus. That's not my Jesus. And his parents contacted their doc, and their doc got it to us. And then the seeing of the light. There's a nice picture of it. It's one of my favorite pictures. This is a young girl. She was 8 years old. She actually presented to my office, oddly enough. She had fulminant mononucleosis, severe liver failure. And her parents inappropriately brought her to my office, but my office is right next to the hospital. I took her over to the hospital. I had to put a needle in her heart to resuscitate her. So that is near death by any criteria. Like I was telling you all, that's why I'm here. Because we don't really have all these kinds of issues that I'm always reading about. Well, are they really near death, and what is death? And I belong to actually a discussion group. They can go on for days and days and days talking about, well, what is death? Come on. We had to put a needle in her heart to resuscitate her. That is in the 15 years of being an intensive care unit physician, it never worked before. That's the only time it ever worked. And her experience is very instructive. She has no memory of coming to the hospital. She has no memory of being in my office. She has no memory of being in the intensive care unit. She has no memory of leaving the hospital. So her, it's a huge memory gap, as we would predict. Except, she says, when you asked the nurses for that crash cart thing, my grandmother was sitting there. And her grandmother was surrounded by this white light. And then this is why I just feel I'm the most blessed person I know. Because she looks at me and she goes, where was I? And I said, I don't know. You tell me, where were you? She says, well, I think I was out of my body. And then I was back. And she clenched her fists like this. Because I said to her, where do you think you went? She goes, that's what I think. That's what I've been trying to figure out. And she's only going to say that once. After then, she learned about near-death experiences, and she talked to her family about it a lot, and I've interviewed her a number of times, and etc. Then it's a much, It's still a fragmentary story, but you know, now it's, I saw my grandmother, I saw the light, etc. But that first time where she goes, that's what I've been trying to figure out. The frustration, the amazement, the astonishment of this experience. This is what tells us that this is something real that happened to her. That this isn't some sort of invention of her mind. Inventions of the mind, that's what they're for. They're to satisfy our anxieties. They're seamless stories that make sense. That's why we have them. So those, I know that there are some mental health professionals here, etc. Just to find this out for myself, I interviewed a lot of patients with alcoholic psychosis or other forms of dementia, and sure enough, that is what they do. You ask them what they had for breakfast, and they tell you a beautiful, seamless story that's completely false. That is not what these children do. Here's a nice example of the light as well. And then the decision to return. I studied near-death experiences. We went to Japan. We studied over 400 Japanese near-death experiences. I went to Africa. We studied 50 African near-death experiences. In neither of those cultures did we hear the decision to return. We do hear that in basically Euro-American children. It's just food for thought. The other day, my daughter was playing in the sandbox. And it was time for her to come in to eat. And she didn't want to. And so I said, well, don't you want to go see mommy? Don't you want to be with your mommy now? You know, mommy's waiting for you. Oh, yeah, she wanted to be with mommy. So she jumped up and came in. But let's face it, if she hadn't, I would have just picked her up and carried her into the house. So, I mean, did she really have a choice? She may have perceived herself as having a choice. That's for sure. And the choice typically is a choice based of love for family. This little girl here wanted me to know that it wasn't my choice, though. As an intensive care unit physician, of course, I'm in the habit of saying, I resuscitated this patient. Our team, let's face it, if I'm really being really humble, I might say our team resuscitated the patient. Anyway, so this young girl here, before she was even extubated, she overheard me saying all this kind of stuff, and she indicated that she wanted her little board, and she wanted me to know that God saved her. It wasn't our team at all. These experiences are not all religious by any means. Most of the experiences that I heard were not religious. This is a non-religious one. This girl here said that she was approached by doctors, and they told her to press a button on that box. And if she pressed the green button, she could go with them, but she would never see her family again. I said to her, well, how did you know they were doctors? She said they were 14 feet tall and they had light bulbs in their bodies. Just like all my doctor friends. So, we can't get around it. This has been actually known for much, much longer than our society. If you want to get me riled up, say that science debunks the near-death experience. Or say that science is against religion or something like that. That is true. The 19th century science was against the failed philosophies of the 17th and 18th century. Sure, I don't doubt that. But in the American Heart Journal in 1968, Burgeon Phillips said, as crude a tool it is, there is no better model presently available to study the natural processes of death than interviewing people about near-death experiences. So, and this is it before Raymond Moody. And there's experimental evidence now. Weird experimental evidence, to be sure. Odd experiments. Secret government experiments, for those of you who are conspiracy theorists, who like that kind of thing. Sure. Throughout the 1990s, Jim Winery is a very good friend of mine who conducted these experiments. Navy wanted to know, what are the greatest accelerating forces that the human brain can stand? Because they were designing aircraft that could go faster than people could fly, because the accelerating forces, the G-forces, were so great that the blood would stop flowing in their brain, and they would lose life and a very expensive aircraft. So in order to properly design these fighter pilots, they took volunteers, and they put them in a centrifuge, and they whirled them to the point of near death. So he's able to actually vary his centrifuge runs to see exactly when everything is happening. After these pilots lost their muscle tone, and after these pilots had seizures, And after they had bladder and bowel incontinence and they're profoundly comatose, a very strange thing happened. They regained consciousness in the last few seconds that theoretically they could still be in the centrifuge, where they regained consciousness and had what we would call a near-death experience. Why doesn't anybody know this? He published it in the Aerospace Journal in 1998. Not too many people read those journals. And these types of studies were not widely publicized by the government. But nevertheless, Jim Winery and I have often laughed that a pediatric intensivist from Seattle and a flight surgeon for the Navy reached the same conclusion about near-death experiences. That paradoxically, at the point of death, consciousness awakens. And it's an expanded sense of consciousness, what arguably is a dead or close to dead brain. So, sure, dead brains can think. No doubt about it. In defiance of what, you know, I was taught in medical school. What my senior resident in medical school said to me, half of what you're going to learn is wrong. The problem is, I don't know which half is wrong. Okay, so it's clear that dead, dysfunctional, dying brains can think and have a greater sense of expanded awareness. Oh, okay, just in case, his near-death experience is a little bit different than the children's. That patch that was there, just in case people don't think that these they were having real near-death experiences, they designed that patch. They themselves, the fighter pilots that went through the centrifuge, designed that patch as a symbol of death that they felt that they had survived. And then I think I told you, we went to Africa, we went to Japan. I worked with an anthropologist named Chris Carr. And all the imagery of the near-death experience that you're aware of is our struggles to understand the experience. And think about it. It makes sense. When I die, if my wife dies before me, I know, as a scientific fact, that she'll be waiting for me. Well, she's not going to be waiting for any of you guys. I mean, come on. But I see people get really caught up in it. They go, well, but wait a minute. I saw a heaven that looked like this, but your child saw a heaven that looked like that. Well, yeah, that's right. If these are lessons of love, and if it's true that we meet whatever this God is when we die, it's going to talk to us each in a language we can understand. And it's coming from a part of our brain that is beyond language anyway, that talks in symbolic terms. You know, that sort of the right side of our brain is a much more symbolic, etc. But the constants are, we learn stuff when we die. So that to me is the greatest piece of circumstantial evidence that something happens after death. Why would we learn stuff when we die? and learning, by the way, is extremely complex. You're never going to convince me or any normal thinking neuroscientist, and for some reason this kind of material makes them stop normally thinking, but if they were thinking normally, learning is extremely complex behavior involving multiple areas of your brain. So the idea that, oh, recently there's been some study out of George Washington that there's some burst of encephalographic information that comes in dying brains, and so maybe the near-death experience is just some sort of final zap. That in no way explains the complex learning that goes on as part of the experience. That's a total brain process that is very complex. So we're conscious, we're aware, and we learn stuff. And specifically, we learn lessons of love. We learn that the meaning of life is our relationships with other human beings. So we die awake and aware of this reality and of other realities. So I'm not going to argue, well, you guys are probably all religious, so it's probably not an argument with you. But many people say these experiences, hallucinations of the dying brain and blah, blah, blah. Okay, sure. I don't see there's any way to argue against that. I'm just pointing out, we should restate that. That the dying process, by any criteria, by the best scientific evidence that we know in the year 2011, is that we die awake, conscious, we can hear what's going on around us, and we're aware of other realities. I've heard there's a million names for God, and maybe one of the names for God is hallucination of another reality. I don't know. Nevertheless, that fact alone brings enormous comfort to families and others at the bedside of the dying. It helps with reconciliation. It helps with dealing with death and dying issues. When we first published our study, I can't tell you how many people called me up and said, thank you. Now I know that when my dad was dying and he wasn't conscious, and I told him, I love you, I love you, I love you. And so many of us, I never told my dad that I loved him for a long time. I understand these stories. And they say, and now I know why my dad's blood pressure kept changing every time I said that. Because he hurt me. I've had intensive care unit nurses say, thank you for telling me what happened when my child died. I felt so guilty that I let you stick all those tubes in her and intubate her and do all the painful and horrible things we do to dying patients. And now I know that somebody was with him when they died. And that in itself, regardless of its implications of life after death, in itself could save this country $6 billion a year. How can I make such an outrageous statement? Because this country, by the most conservative estimates from the Journal of the American Medical Association, spends $6 billion a year on end-of-life care that does not extend life one second. I'm not talking about the controversies of, for example, my patients. We resuscitated 400 or 500 of them, and only a handful live. That's an ethical issue. I'm not talking about $100,000 to extend life 6 weeks. I'm talking about end-of-life care that does not extend life one second. Why do we do it? Because we're afraid of dying. And the doctors say the patients insist on it, and the patients say the doctors insist on it, and yet the dying process, regardless of whether you want to call it hallucination or real or whatever you want to call it, the dying process is spiritually dynamic. Lots of really cool stuff is happening. Reconciliation issues are happening. The seeds of potential grief resolution are happening. And these things are all important, and they should be listened to. And if we could start to use this understandings in death of dying care, we would see all this irrational medical care just wither away. So, to me, there is a real as any other experience. But, alright, I know that's not enough for you. Well, it wasn't enough for me, I know it's not enough for you guys. You guys want to know, but are they real? Okay. And that's what this young man wanted to know.
Went to space and it didn't have anything in your way. It wasn't like a spiral noodle, so it's either a tunnel or a noodle. And it was a rainbow.
Horrendous crash on a snowy mountain bridge plunged 3-year-old Chris Eggleston into a freezing lake.
Was that scary?
Yeah. And our mom yelled to take our seatbelts off. But when we crashed, behind us was a car with neutral in it. He was the person who saved my life. He saw us go around the curve, but when he came around the curve, he didn't see us anymore. So he took his flashlight and looked down off the bridge, and he could see us. He could see our car. So he had to dive like 5 or 6 times to get down far enough to get to it. And during all that time, I was having a near-death experience.
Chris Eggleston had, again, a typical child's near-death experience in the sense that it's brief, fragmentary, difficult to comprehend.
I started falling through this new world, coming closer and closer, and I went inside it.
And he was in a car, which filled up with water, and he nearly drowned. He said suddenly everything went blank. He was then out of his body, surprised to be there, felt that eventually he could learn to swim or somehow move himself in the air, said that he went to a place that he called the human heaven and made some sort of choice to return to his body. But interestingly enough, he says that he was in a huge noodle until he realized that noodles don't have rainbows in them, so it must have been some sort of tunnel.
Children's experiences have the common features.
And then I didn't know which was which, so I started floating down the white sea and the water. Then I ran into this humongous flower. And then inside I found a honeybee bee that was like as big as I was, and that was like 3 feet. I knew he liked me because he gave me some bread.
His parents had no religious beliefs whatsoever. He doesn't encounter something that he thought was God. His heaven is a very commonplace description of heaven in that it was a golden castle with pearly gates, the kind of thing that I think virtually every child is exposed to. He says he had a bumblebee as a helper that assisted him with the experience. In other words, I think a more religious child typically describes guardian angels as assisting them with the experience. In his case, it was a bumblebee, a very non-religious image in keeping with his very non-religious background. The one message I've learned from children's near-death experiences is that we die the life we live.
Went to three, and didn't have anything in your way. It wasn't like a spiral noodle, so it's either a tunnel or a noodle, and it was a rainbow.